Gospel of Mark in chapter 8. We've come to a high point in the Gospel. We've come to a high point in the Gospel. Remember, it's split into two halves, and we reach the pinnacle of that first half. We're going to see what the event is that makes this part so special this afternoon. Jesus is changing the way in which he is dealing with people, and he reveals some things that is not yet said until this point. Let's read from Mark chapter 8 and verse 27. It says, "Now Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And on the road he asked his disciples, saying to them, 'Who do men say that I am?'" Jesus has just healed a man, a blind man in Bethsaida. He took him out of the town, because that town was one which didn't believe in him. And he walks up. Jesus is walking north in Israel, going from Bethsaida up to this place called Caesarea Philippi. I'll remind you of that trip to Israel that is planned for next autumn. And this is a place that you'll visit if you're able to go there. Caesarea Philippi was an interesting place, an ancient place. It was ruled by Philistines, and they called it Banias. It was in that place in which the god Pan was worshipped. So we've heard of Pan pipes. Pan pipes were used to worship this god Pan. He was a goat-type figure, and he was the god of the woods and all sorts of things. So up in Caesarea Philippi, Pan was worshipped. And then the Romans came, and Herod, who was under the Romans, he beautified the place and he built temples in this area, and he called it Caesarea. His son Philip, because he was a good guy, called it after himself and named it Caesarea Philippi. They set up lots of temples there, and they worshipped all sorts of gods, including Caesar. And each loyal Roman citizen at the time had to say, "Caesar is Lord," and they would offer a pinch of salt as some sort of sacrifice to him, saying that he was deity. So what do we know about Caesarea Philippi then? It was the whole panoply of gods that were on offer. It was like a supermarket of gods. You could choose, you know, who you want to worship. You've got 20 types of baked beans. You've got 20 types of gods. This is where Jesus is taking his disciples. On the way, though, he asks them a question. "Who do men say that I am?" Now, if I said this to Warren, I said, "Warren, what are people saying about me? What are people saying about Matt?" That would be me being quite insecure, wouldn't it? Be me thinking, "Oh, what are people thinking about me? I hope they're thinking good things." Is that what Jesus has in mind? No. No. He wants to know. Well, who do men say that I am? Verse 28, "So they answered, 'John the Baptist.'" Who was it who thought, who confused Jesus with John the Baptist before? It was Herod. And we read the story of how he had executed John. But then Jesus, he thought, was Herod, John come back to life again to haunt him. Just as John the Baptist preached, Jesus preached repentance. So that was probably why he was confused with John. But some say Elijah. This morning, Paul, when he was teaching about communion, said that the Jews expect Elijah to come before the Christ, because it says so in Malachi. Elijah, what do we know about him? He called a sinful generation again to repentance, and he also worked miracles. So we can see why Jesus would be maybe confused with Elijah. But others, verse 28, say one of the prophets, Just a man of God who is speaking God's words. You know, if that was anyone else, they would be content to be up there with John the Baptist, or to be up there with Elijah, or even one of the prophets. But is this who Jesus is? Verse 29, he said to them, he says to the disciples, on the way up to Caesarea Philippi, "But who do you say that I am?" The thing which makes this a pivotal point in Mark's gospel is the words that come next. "Who do you say that I am?" Jesus isn't really concerned so much about what other people say. Who do people say Jesus is today? Well, even the atheist would say Jesus was a skilled teacher. The Muslims would say Jesus was one of the prophets. They would even say that he was born of a virgin. The Jews, some of them, claim him as one of their respected rabbis. The cults have him as the brother of Lucifer and all sorts of things, or one of the gods. But what was said next? "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "You are the Christ." Then he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. "You are the Christ," Peter said. Peter, we know, is the one who would often blurt things out. He'd often get himself in trouble. He'd put his foot in his mouth. But here he boldly says what he is being led to believe, that Jesus is the Christ. Now, when we look at this, we think Jesus Christ. Okay, Jesus is his first name. Christ is his surname, like Yvonne Cooper. No. No, Jesus, yes, is his name. That's what was given to him. But Christ is not his surname. Christ is his title. What does a Christ mean? Well, a Christ is the Greek version of the Hebrew word Mashiach or Messiah. Both of these both mean anointed. Anointed. So in the Old Testament, if you were a priest called into service, especially a high priest, there was a large ceremony that would take place and you would be anointed with oil to set you apart as a priest. If you were going to be one of the prophets, they had schools of prophets in the Old Testament, they would be anointed with oil. And the kings too were anointed. We remember how Saul was anointed and also how David was anointed too. So to be anointed means to be set apart and to be empowered by God for a particular mission. The Jews knew that there was one coming who would be anointed, who would be set apart, who would be God's chosen one sent from him. The Christ was sent straight from God. In Mark chapter 14 and verse 61, Jesus is, we skip forward in the life of Christ to the night of his betrayal, and he's here before the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish council. They are able to pin nothing on him. He's done nothing wrong. People come and try and make accusation against him, nothing. In verse 61, Jesus kept silent and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." When the high priest tore his clothes and said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. You see, in their minds, to call yourself the Christ, if you were not, would be blasphemy. Because he's so closely linked to God, and in fact he is God. So for Peter then, to come out and say this, you are the Christ, was huge. He's saying, I believe you are the one prophesied sent from God. In John chapter 3, verse 16, very familiar words. Most well-known verse in the Bible. I wonder, do you know the verses that follow it? John chapter 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. To believe that Jesus is the Christ is a matter of life and death. He who believes in him is not condemned. He who does not believe is condemned already. 1 John chapter 2 as well talks about this. 1 John 2 and verse 22. It says, who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist, who denies the Father and the Son. 1 John 2:23. Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father either. He who acknowledges the Son has the Father also. You know, there are some who come very close to being Christians in their doctrine, their teaching. You know, they have all sorts of things. They meet on a Sunday, they do this, this, and this. They go and they evangelize very strictly. They have a Bible of some description. But they do not say that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Son of God come in the flesh. And according to 1 John 2, they are of Antichrist. They don't have the Father because they don't confess the Son as being God himself. Friends, this is so significant. Who do you say Jesus is?
The God.
Yes, absolutely, Nico.
That you can't see and he is in heaven.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And in our hearts.
Thank you, Nico. And that is right. That is absolutely right, Nico. But here, we could see him because he still had the body of a person. And the people had to decide, his disciples had to decide, who do you say I am? You know, these words are so significant. What we do with Jesus, who we say he is, will impact where we spend eternity. Not just we, but every single person. Who do we say he is? And it's me as an individual that will be responsible. You know, as I stand before God, he's not going to say, Matt, who did your mum think I was? And I'll say, well, my mum, yeah, she followed you and she said this, this and this. He's not going to say, who did your pastor say I was? God is not going to say, who did your school teacher, your RE teacher say I was? But who do you say Jesus was? And what have you done about it? God doesn't have any grandchildren. Just because my mum or my dad are Christians, that doesn't mean that I am. We must make that personal confession for ourselves, just as Peter did, and say, I believe Jesus is the Christ. That he is the one sent of God for that mission, to die for the sins of the world, including my own, and to rise again. I believe he is my rescuer. He is my only hope. He is the one who was anointed, set apart and empowered for that mission to save me. And because I believe that, he is my Lord and my God. But Jesus in verse 30 strictly warns them that they should tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. So as soon as Jesus is revealed as a Christ, he goes on to say these things. I'm going to suffer, I'll be rejected. I'm going to be killed and after 3 days rise again. This was new. This had not been said before. I was in Portugal this last week for JJ's wedding, and there was a member of JJ's family who we were privileged to be able to share the gospel with and talk about Jesus with. And he had the impression that Jesus, he just came into the world and then he sort of stumbled upon all these things and did all these good things. And then it was such a shame that he was put to death in such a way. But we were able to show him that actually Jesus coming was in fulfillment of prophecy. This was God's plan. It says there in verse 31, he began to teach him that the Son of Man must suffer. He must suffer, implying that there was a plan and he must follow it. There was a reason he must accomplish it. There was a place that was set apart for the Christ. Way back when in Genesis, when Abraham had been waiting for a child for such a long time, finally, after about 20 years, God gave he and Sarah a son. His name was Isaac. He was a child of promise. And he loved his son, as of course any father would. But even more so because he'd waited for so long. Yet there came a point when Isaac had grown up. We don't know how old he was. He was probably at least a teenager. And the Lord had said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, take him up onto the mountain and offer him to me as a burnt offering. And it says that Abraham, the very next day, rose up, took his donkey, some servants, and went with his son to this place. This place was Mount Moriah. And there he was willing to even put his son on an altar. And we say, how could a loving God be willing to do that? Well, he didn't let him go through with it. God didn't necessarily say, this is what happened, but he would. Do you know that is the very first mention of love in the scripture? It's not the love of Adam for Eve or anything else. It's the love of a father for a son. And in connection with that love, that father was even willing to give his son in obedience. There was a place set aside for Christ because that same Mount Moriah is the same range in which Calvary was and where Jesus was put on the cross. The time was specific. The way in which he would be killed was specific. What would happen with his clothes and his possessions and his body was specific. The Son of Man must suffer these things. It says in verse 32 that he spoke this word openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Can you blame Peter? Can you blame him? He's just finally had this confirmation. Yes, I knew it. Jesus is the Christ. But then straight after, Jesus says, well, actually, I'm going to be betrayed and I'm going to be put to death at the hands of hostile leaders. You can't blame Peter for saying, hold on now, Lord. Far be this from you. You're the Christ, after all. In the Jewish mind, they saw Messiah as coming. You're familiar with this. To come in and bring a political revolution, maybe, or to kick the Romans out by force. But what Christ revealed was something very different. Verse 33. But when Jesus had turned around away from Peter and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of man." Does it not seem a bit extreme that Jesus called his closest disciple Satan? Seems a bit extreme to me. Why would he say that? Looking at the cross of Christ, why was it opposed? And why did Jesus call Peter Satan? Well, turn with me please to Matthew chapter 4 and verse 8. This is in the time of Jesus' temptation. The devil tempted him in three ways. But in Matthew 4, verse 8, it's the last of the temptations according to Matthew. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain. And he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, "All these things I will give to you, if you will fall down and worship me." Then Jesus said to him, "Away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve." And the devil left him. And behold, angels came and served him. What was Satan offering here? He was offering a crown to be king over all these nations that he was offering him a crown without the cross. Satan would have Jesus short-circuit God's plan, skip the cross, and supposedly receive this kingdom, because he knew that the cross was very significant. And again, he rears his head and he uses a person. He uses one of Jesus' own followers to try and offer that cross, that crown, without the cross. We shouldn't be surprised when we are hurt by other believers, just by way of application. Peter was used by the enemy, and unfortunately the same can be true with us too. We should recognise that the enemy is the enemy and not the person, because Satan can do that, and he's tricky. The person might not even realise they're being used by Satan to discourage or to misdirect you, just as Peter was probably doing so in good conscience. But it can happen. Yet Jesus realised. He said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." See, what would the cross of Christ achieve? This which seemed so contradictory to Peter, what would it achieve? Hebrews 2 says something about this. Hebrews 2 and verse 14. Says that God was willing to become man, one of the children of God, so to speak. And says, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself, that is Jesus, likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." How wonderful this is. How marvellous this is. That Jesus came to destroy him who had the power over death, and to release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. The fear of death is a universal thing. We want to avoid it. Some people do that by totally ignoring death. They don't want to hear anything about death. They don't want to go to a funeral. They don't want to do anything. Some people make up their own fanciful ideas about what happens after you die. Oh, you just go into the ground and that's it. Or, oh, you come back as something else. Or whatever it might be. Or, oh, everyone goes to heaven. It'll be okay in the end. There's a universal fear of death. I was speaking to some people at work this week. We work in a hospital, and sadly, death occurs there. And it makes you think. You can't avoid it. And this lady said, do you know, I do think about these things, and I am afraid to die. Christ's cross meant that he could release those who, through fear of death, are all their lifetime subject to bondage. That fear, that being held. He frees us. He frees us from the penalty of sin. It will never be brought up against us. Never. He's paid the price once and for all, totally. He does free us from the power of sin. And he frees us from that bondage of fear. And because of the cross of Christ, he'll free us from the presence of sin too. And we can go and be with him in heaven. You can see why Satan would want him to avoid this. And why he would prompt Peter to say such a thing as he did. Because Jesus came that he might destroy him, who had the power of death, that is the devil. He came to crush this heel, the head of the serpent, who is Satan. And he did that through the cross, through his shed blood there. The cross, we make it something clean and nice. We make it a piece of jewellery, don't we? We put one on the front of our Bible, and it's so nice. We put one on the front of the church building. The cross was and is a form of execution. It would be the same as having an electric chair on the front of your building, or having a lethal injection. The cross is not something pretty in itself, but it is beautiful because of what Jesus achieved there for us. But Jesus goes on to say something else. He rebukes Peter, and then in verse 34, it says, when he called the people to himself, with his disciples also, he said to them, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. This is the cross, not only of Christ, but the cross of the Christian, the one who would follow Jesus. Following Jesus isn't just making a decision and then forgetting about it. It's not even just attending church. This is what it means to be a follower of Christ, in his own words. Denying oneself, taking up one's cross, and following him. What does this involve then? To deny yourself. Do you know, to deny yourself is not the same as self-denial? What is self-denial? It might be, you know, you're on a diet and you're going to say, I'm not going to drink Coca-Cola, or I'm not going to eat chocolate, or whatever it might be. That's self-denial. But we do that for selfish reasons, because I want my body to be fitter, or I want to look more attractive, whatever it might be. This self-denial is actually selfish. So Jesus is not talking about self-denial, about following Lent or whatever it might be, or living in a cave, but denying self. And there is a difference. Today there's a big emphasis on my rights, isn't there? You have groups that campaign for their rights. You have, well, we can think of some, that really stamp and say, we want this and we want it now and you better sort us out. They're all about their rights. Following Christ is to relinquish your rights. And we fight against it and we think, oh, people are going to walk all over us. People walked all over Jesus. Yes, there is a time, and we see in Paul's life when he went through Roman policy. But that was not the norm, that was not every day. And the Christian experience is to deny oneself. It means to be dead to yourself. That same Apostle Paul, who, yeah, he went through Roman policy, he said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 31, I die daily. He died to himself. He died to his own selfish ambitions of what he wanted to do, of what he wanted to become. He died to what other people thought of him. You know, we all have that in built into us, don't we? We want to be respected. We want to be thought well of. He died to that. Or maybe he died to the possibility of getting gain from people. It seems that he died to the possibility of even having family. We think he was single. And that was something which, no doubt, he wanted to. He was a man. He probably wanted to be married, but he died to that. I die daily. That's what he said. You know, when you follow someone, by necessity, you have to walk in the same steps they have. If I say to Nico, I'm going to follow you out of church, that means that Nico has gone through those set of doors first, walked over the mat, and then gone through the second set. You don't have to. No, you don't have to. But if I say I'm going to follow him, I do exactly the same, don't I? What was the path which Jesus walked? Well, it led to rejection. It led to people mistreating him, saying bad things about him. It led to him being rejected and betrayed and put to death, even though he was innocent. If we want to follow him, we ought to follow him and not take the easy route. Why is there opposition to this in ourselves, this denying self and taking up the cross and following him? Let's read verse 35 downwards. Jesus said, "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Our flesh loves comfort. Our flesh loves quick gain without thinking about the future. Our flesh loves that respect and avoiding shame. But what does following Christ, what does denying self, taking up our cross, achieve? Jesus said that whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake in the Gospels will save it. People might look at you and think, how stupid you are, giving up time that you could spend with your family to go and be at church, or leaving behind part of your career to go and serve God in some way, or not cheating on your taxes or whatever, so you could be honest in your conscience before God. You say, what a fool. Or when you go out of your way to tell someone about Christ and they mock you for it, you say, what a fool, just pack it in. You know, those people who are trying to save their life according to Christ will lose it. It will be like sand that you try and grasp and it just slips through your fingers. Ecclesiastes talks about the person who laboured for the wind. All of his work, he got a big handful of air. Nothing there. But Jesus said that whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. You know, if you sense God telling you to give up what you're doing now, and he confirms it through his word to other people, give it up. Because you will save your life eternally. Not saying that you're going to earn your salvation, but there will be reward in heaven for that. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? John Rockefeller, at one point the richest man in the world, he earned his money through oil. When he died in 1937, somebody reportedly asked, how much did he leave behind? The answer was very simple. All of it. Everything he had, he left behind. He could take nothing with him. Only those things that he'd sent on ahead if he was a believer, which I don't know. There's nothing I could take with me apart from those things I send on ahead. We are to lay up treasures in heaven. How do we do that? Following him, denying self, dying to self in place of Christ. He was the one who was willing to say, not my will, which would have been more comfortable maybe, but thy will be done. I ought to say that too. Of worship to him, showing that he is worthy, but also knowing that there is reward in heaven for that. We know that well-known saying as well from Jim Elliot, missionary to South America in the 1950s. He and I think it was four other men heard of this tribe had never been reached. They were savage people living in the jungle. But they flew out in the plane. They tried to drop parcels of food, etc., gifts to win over the people. And finally, they built up the courage and thought the timing was right to land the plane there in the jungle with the Akua people. Over the first few days, they got to know a few people. They thought things were going well, and they wrote as such in the diaries. But then, after some time, they heard the noise of people coming through the woods. And it was the soldiers, the spearmen of that tribe. And they came and they murdered the missionaries, including Jim Elliot. But Jim Elliot had written in his diary this, that he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose in eternity. It's right in line with what Jesus says. He said, for whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation. Friends, that's us. That's us too. An adulterous and sinful generation. We were there too. We had dug from that same pit. We're not higher than anybody else. But this is an adulterous and sinful generation. If we're ashamed of Christ and his words, the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Just as certain as was Christ's coming in the first place, fulfilling prophecy, is his return. Jesus is coming again. Jesus will catch up his church to be with himself, and then he will return to judge the world. There's coming a time when, if we're a Christian, we are going to be judged not for our sin, but what we call the judgment seat of Christ, which is a place of reward. He's going to burn off those things that were just nothing. Those things that were done with a selfish motive. Those times when we have not denied self and followed Christ, but we've gone our own way, and they'll be burnt up. Only what is left are those sacrifices we've made for him. Of our time, of our money, of our reputation, whatever it might be. Done in faith. With the sole motive of pleasing him. And that is a motivation to us, or ought to be, to follow him, to die to self, to take up our cross daily and follow him. And it gives a freedom. You know, we're free then from popular opinion. If we're living for the audience of one and for his praise alone, then it doesn't really matter what so-and-so down the street thinks or what that person in my family thinks. Because I'm living for God. It brings a freedom. Let us be a church who follow Christ. Not on paper, but in the way in which we live. Not being selfish with the things he's given. But showing that he is worthy of our sacrifice. Not pursuing our own goals to the neglect and to the pushing out of what he would have for our life. Those who lose their life for my sake in the Gospels will save it. Let us be those who say and even challenge people, hey, who do you say Jesus is? I found him to be the Christ. I found him to be the one who's taken away my sin, who's given me life, who's given me hope, who's taken away that fear of death. Take that gospel. Let us be those that follow Christ. How good that he's gone there first. He doesn't expect us to do anything that he has not done. The servant is not greater than his master. He went there for us. Let us be those who follow Christ.